the number one thing we need to think about is lifestyle. What can we do to encourage our patients to become responsible and be active in their care? And that means move and get better sleep and dealing with stress and understanding there are some very interesting and very simple tools that they could actually utilize.
Welcome to the Express Soul Health and Wellness Podcast. In each episode, you'll learn from experts about the best practices and technologies to live a happier, healthier, and hopefully a longer life. Here is your host, Claudia Erdenola.
Hi, welcome to Express Soul Health and Wellness Podcast. If this is your first time at my podcast, my name is Claudia Erdenola. I am your host. I am a professional engineer with a passion for health and wellness. I like to invite professionals in the healthcare industry to my podcast to give us perspective and better ways in which you, me, and anyone can take control of their health, of our health, to live longer, happier, and healthier lives. If this is the kind of content that you like to listen, stay with us and please join us by subscribing to our podcast and hitting the notification bell so you will not miss an episode here in our podcast. Also, I would like for you to follow us in all our social media outlets. Today, we have the pleasure to talk to Dr. Laurie Marvas. Dr. Marvas is a double certified family medicine and lifestyle medicine physician who has been utilizing food as medicine since 2012. She is currently holding 50 states' medical licenses, including DC, across the United States. She has a concierge practice and is accepting new patients at drmarvas.com. We are posting all of Dr. Marvas' information, her website, and her contact information in the description box for all of you who would like to visit her website and contact her for her services. She is a co-founder of The Healing Kitchen with Brittany Gerudi, where a chef and a doctor come together in the kitchen to provide a recipe for health. Dr. Marvas is a specialized doctor into the plant-based diet, and here we're going to have part of her experiences with her own family and with her patients that she has been treating with what the plant-based diet. She's going to share with us her insights and experiences in the nutritional benefits of the plant-based diet. As a United States Air Force veteran, she served in the Middle East and in South America. She's also a wife, mom of a 3 grown children, author, a speaker, and avid runner. In our podcast, we're going to have part one and part two in our conversation with Dr. Marvas. Part one, we are discussing the healthcare delivery system in the United States and getting Dr. Marvas' perspective in what we consider today a very expensive and ineffective healthcare delivery system. We've seen a massive spending of dollars and very little return of the investment, as we see that we are ranking so low, about 69 in the worldwide ranking into the overall health of the population versus the spending. So it's going to be a very good discussion with Dr. Marvas. You don't want to miss. In part two, we are going to discuss more on the lifestyle medicine that she's a specialist, and she's going to share with us, as I said, all of her views and the nutritional value of a plant-based diet. We have a lot of information from her about the blue zones, great practices that anyone can implement to, you know, get a better lifestyle and improve the overall health. So two parts, don't miss. This is going to be amazing. She's very smart, and you're going to like what you're going to listen. I let my listeners to decide. I think it's good that we have perspectives from, you know, different opinions, different ways of seeing health and wellness. So with no further ado, here it is, Dr. Marvas. So, Dr. Lauri Marvas, thank you so much for accepting our invitation to Express All Health and Wellness podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you so much. I would like for you to give us a little brief description of your background. So for our audience to know and giving perspective about your experience.
Sure. I am an Air Force veteran, as you may have shared. I went through medical school with three children. So I had gone to college and I always wanted to be a physician since I was about 10. So I'm a family medicine physician by training, board certified, and really understood, you know, the value of providing care. I always wanted to be part of that healing natures. When my sister got sick and she got well, I was like, wow, I want to be a part of that. And so I went through medical school in Texas and residency, and then I joined the Air Force and got out, went on to Colorado and continued to practice general family medicine. And then I discovered what you could call lifestyle medicine. I'm also board certified in lifestyle medicine, which is really the focus on how wellness and certain habits and certain activities that we kind of all take for granted can really benefit us in large, large ways. And so that is kind of my training in a nutshell. I've started companies, I've sold companies, I'm licensed in all 50 states and DC to see patients via telemedicine. That's a whole nother story, but basically that's it in a nutshell.
Perfect. Thank you very much. So Bruce, part of the reasons for you to be here with us today is we want to get from you perspective and questions regarding the healthcare delivery system in the United States of America. Like Dr. Marvas, we like to think that the healthcare system in a country so sophisticated like ours would be supporting the wellness instead of being focused on the disease management and all of this money spent and all of stuff. So I know you have some questions for Dr. Marvas, so go ahead.
Nice to meet you, Dr. Marvas. I, like you, am an Air Force veteran. Maybe a different time, different vintage. I had deployment to Southeast Asia during the midst of the conflict over there. And I also spent time in Colorado at Cheyenne Mountain Complex.
Okay.
So in Colorado Springs. So anyway, and also I have a long history in healthcare administration as well as information technology, specifically for electronic medical record systems. I sort of grew up in that industry. So I have some questions pertaining and like to get your perspective on the healthcare delivery system. Sort of question number one. We spend massive amounts of money on sick care in this country. That amount is calculated around $5 trillion a year. That's trillion with a T. And that number is rising. It's projected to be $8 trillion within the next 5 years. That said, that's one thing, spending the money. But if you look at the statistics by the World Health Organization or even on Google, we rank 69th in the world in overall state of the health. Our population. It seems to me that we're receiving a bad return on investment for spending $5 trillion, which is more than the next five countries, sophisticated countries in the world. So two-part question. Don't you think there's a more effective way of spending our money to impact the healthcare, our population, part one? Part two, if you held the purse strings for this $5 trillion, how would you spend the money?
Oh my, oh my. Well, that is a very breadth and depth question. So I'll do my best. coming out of, you know, I've been a physician for over two decades now. And I've been in a variety of different healthcare settings. So I've worked for the government. I've been deployed to the Middle East. I've seen how that care system works. It's very politically driven. I've seen patients that I felt should be shipped home actually kept where they are based on the duties required. And it was, you know, that's one clue, is that we are not seeing the individual, right? We're seeing a system here that's trying to continue to feed the system. And it's like this huge growing mud, right? You just can't shake it off because it just keeps sticking to you. And the harder you try, the more exhausted you get until people just get tired. Going on to the next component of that, I mean, I came up through the typical American education system. I got a wonderful education at Texas Tech in West Texas, as far as learning what all doctors learn. We learn about disease. We learn about intervention. We learn about anatomy and pathophysiology and pharmaceuticals, right? We understand how to react to a system. So we are built from the beginning in an education system to react, right? We're never taught to prevent. And that will get me back to where I think the answer lies. But then as you go into training, right, it's really a matter of you really understand how sick patients are. You know, my daughter is now a physician and a family medicine physician, and her acuity of illness, the polypharmacy mm-hmm. and the severity of illness in younger Americans is alarming, right? And speaking of the military, we can't even recruit the numbers that we need. They're actually putting people through basically, quote unquote, a fat camp is what they're describing it, to get people ready, just to get ready to try to join the military. This is an unfortunate situation. One in every three Americans are either pre-diabetic or diabetic. Majority don't even know it. And again, I could go down rabbit holes for all these, but I'm trying to stay high here. Now, with that understanding, when we look at our system as a whole, we're a reactive system. We're a disease system. We're a sick care system. We're not a healthcare system. There are many players in the mix. It's not an easy answer. It's a complicated system. We have our food system at play. We have an environment that's not meant to help us continue to move. We don't have walkable cities. We're pulling our children out of physical, you know, activity, right? So PE is not so much PE. Their recess has been shortened. We're giving our children drugs early on, thinking that, you know, if you have ADHD, it couldn't be the food and it couldn't be that they need exercise, right? That would be too simple. We really are trying to, again, write a prescription, do an intervention. And on top of that, if you look at healthcare administration, the burden has dramatically increased. You'll see the number of physicians has stayed, maybe climbed a little bit, but the administration that's managing the healthcare is significant. So that takes more dollars to support, meaning doctors have less time for their patients. They are more inclined to need to be run-of-the-mill, see more patients faster. The fastest way to do that is to write a prescription or send for x-rays. Okay, you need to go see this specialist. So now the primary care doctor is literally just a referral machine. We don't sit down and actually understand our patients into the soul of a patient and understand what they're needing to heal is so much more than just a prescription. So there's that piece, right? So we need to see more patients. Now we're also seeing some mid-levels, PAs, nurse practitioners thrown in the mix that are replacing your primary care physicians. So physicians are feeling burnt out. Physicians have the highest suicide rate of any profession. Approximately 400 physicians or physicians in training will kill themselves annually, which is more than a medical school class, which breaks my heart. And so when we think of the stress and the burnout, we are humans as well, you know, doctors, and trying to take care of these patients. So we have sicker patients. We have a system that's breeding sicker patients in a sicker system, mm-hmm. A sicker environment, right? Our society. We allow advertising of pharmaceuticals to our U.S. general audience. Right. There's only two countries in the world that allow that. It's New Zealand and the U.S. Right, exactly. So that in and of itself, you know, I can't even tell you how many times I've had patients come in and say, Dr. Marbus, I saw this on TV. Do you think that would be appropriate for me? Now, if you have a physician who's struggling, we want to write that prescription because we are also getting graded by the patients, right? So you will get scored based on the satisfaction of patients. So mm-hmm. you may write a pain pill prescription because they said they're in pain, right? So now we see this pain epidemic where people are addicted to pain medications. And when they can't get the prescription anymore, then they go to the streets. They get other things. And so you can see where this system at the root is breeding more and more. It's kind of like chronic disease. If you don't address the root cause, it's going to continue. If you just try to fix the top layers, I always tell people, think of diabetes as fire. and the smoke is the glucose, right? So all these medications try to keep the smoke and waft it away, but we never get to the root cause, right? So anyway, that is a great example. Now, if I own the purse springs, to get to the second, I would start at the root. Oh, man. I would not allow lobbyists in Congress. I would have terms going to, if we're going to start here, that Congress, people who run for Congress, they get a limited terms, just like our presidents and senators. Everybody should have limits. That way, we're not just someone in there for 50 years. And lobbyists should not be able to sway how they are taking care of their constituents. That's number one. Number two is really understanding that we have to go and train our medical students about the number one thing we need to think about is lifestyle. What can we do to encourage our patients to become responsible and be active in their care? And that means move and get better sleep and dealing with stress and understanding there are some very interesting and very simple tools that they could actually utilize. There's so much pain and suffering and anguish in patients, right? They're coming to you because when they don't feel well, they're exhausted, they're highly stressed, you know, their kids are not doing well. I mean, there's so much, right? And so people just feel overwhelmed. And when they get to the doctor's office, it's like, just give me something quick so I can just go on and try to deal with the rest of my life. We're not thriving as humans. We are literally suffering. And there's so much more that we could do. But as far as the purse springs, I'd also speak to city planners. Like, how can we make, you know, what can we do in our cities to allow people to feel comfortable and safe to go? I would help, you know, let's address the homeless situation or the unsheltered. What do they need to help? So many of them are previous vets, right?
Right.
So many of them are children that went through the system, you know, they were in the foster system, and then they're struggling and they're in pain. What can we do to help these folks, right? It's not just, oh, give them a house, but we got to support them in what they need. And, you know, from that standpoint, and then I would say we have to hold people accountable for the companies that are providing fast food. We should stop subsidizing foods that are going to be ultra processed and make make us sick. I mean, they hire food scientists to create what I call frankenfoods to make people addicted to these ultra processed foods that all they do is cause inflammation and chronic disease. There's so much that we should be holding corporations responsible for. They need to be socially engaged, not just monetarily. It's not, and I'm all for capitalism and making money and doing your thing. That's how we thrive and build and grow. That's wonderful. But there has to be some component where someone is held in responsible for what they're doing. And so we can't just disregard that. And so that, and then I would again start with our medical students, because they really can be a voice of change in a society. They probably have anywhere between 1,500 to 2,000 people on their panels, right? Their patient panels. Imagine if we had every single one of these patient advocates that are stuck in every city in the world, or in the world, that would be great, in the country, literally saying the same thing. We need to move more. You need to eat better, more fiber, more fruits and vegetables. You know, let's bring your kids into the equation. Let's get them cooking in the kitchen so they understand how to cook. So many people don't even know how to boil water. There's so many stories. But yeah, that's where I would start, is changing, shifting our education system for the medical school. And then really speaking to, we have to put limits on the people who are making the laws and the rules and getting out of where the interest of the constituents is not being held up. It's the interest of companies and such. So it is a very large issue, but it absolutely can change, but it's going to have to start from the ground up, because nobody's going to change it up here that's, you know, getting all the benefits. They're just so disengaged from the system.
Thank you. Extremely good answer. Thank you very much. And today we're in a world of corporate medicine. We have hospital chains with 300, 400, 500 hospitals. We have large payer organizations that influence the payment side. Aren't more physicians becoming employees of these health corporations rather than individual practitioners?
Yeah. I will tell you, it's not easy when to think to, you know, beforehand, you would graduate medical school and just put up a shingle and say, doctor available to, right, here we go. And it's a complicated system. Let me just walk you through what you have to do to even become a physician in this country. One, you go through college, right? So you have to have a four-year degree with a certain particular thing. Then you apply to medical school. It's a very competitive thing. You have to take a thing called the MCAT. And depending on your score and your interviews, then you can get accepted to medical school. It's a four-year process. It's a very arduous process to go through medical school. And then on top of that, then you start applying for residencies. Not only that, we have to pay for our medical school. So the majority of medical students graduate with $250,000 in student debt on top of their college education. And so then you go and you work literally 60, 80, 100 hours a week. They say there's rules to stop that. No, there's ways around that. Anyway, so here you are, and you're being paid very minimal. So now we have a very stressed human taking care of other stressed humans, right? So when you think about just how that system is, so we're seeing this skewed of medical graduates going to specialties, which in of themselves would be even harder to be own your own business. Okay, then you have to be, if you want to see patients in any state, you have, and if you're seeing patients just in person, you just get that state license, you pay that license to that state, your that medical board. Now, if you want to see patients across the entire country, you have to get each state license. And I know I'm very in depth. I know exactly. It's very expensive. Mm-hmm. Then you have malpractice insurance, right? So it depends on where you are. So Florida can be a highly litigious state, right? Certain other states are as well. And others like Texas have created some boundaries to where that could be. So, doctors are, they react, and other healthcare providers as well, by, again, what can make the patient happy and, you know, CYA at the same time. Okay, so now you have patients who all this is occurring. Of course, it's going to be easier to go work for a large corporation versus going to start your own business. Plus, there's just, we're not taught how to run a business in medical school. We're taught how to help people. It's very difficult in this day and age, unless you step out of the insurance system, because the insurance piece is very difficult. You have to apply. That takes 3 to 4 months to get accepted. And then once you apply, they may decide, well, I see that you submitted this and we've accepted you, but I don't like this diagnosis, and I don't like this. We're not going to pay you. So then you have to have a process and a team that will go and try and get the pennies that you're trying to get based on, you know, if you look at the cost that it to become a provider for someone, and then what you're getting paid back to take care of someone on an hourly, the delta is so big. It's like the Grand Canyon, right? You would have to see 10 times the number of people to even just cover your cost to get to that point.
You have to love the profession.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the thing is, you walk into it not knowing. And by the time that you're done and you do understand the vastness and the severity of how broken our system is, you're stuck because you have $250,000 of educational debt just in medical school. And you know what? You spent a decade of your life or more in training. You're not going to not do this unless there's another viable way. I would make medical school free. I would say if you go to medical school and you work 2 years in a, like, let's say a community healthcare center, you have no medical school debt. That's what I would do. And it would also provide some type of low cost care to maybe indigent populations and different things like that. So I've thought about that a lot. But the piece here is that's so important is understanding that the person that's doing the care says, yeah, sign me up. You're going to just pay me a regular salary check and I get to see patients and raise okay, fine. That is literally, and they provide bonuses. They provide all sorts of stuff. So now you have this system that's building, right? And this, again, I talked about that administration, but the doctor or the healthcare provider doesn't have freedom to be innovative and think about ways to help patients, right? They have to really do these outside of them. So many of my friends and colleagues that are going into what we describe as lifestyle medicine, they were burnt out by a broken system. And you will have seen that number at the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. The numbers are just burdening. So like 10, 14 years ago, you'll see maybe 200 people at a conference. Now you're seeing 2,000 plus 10,000 online looking and listening. And when you go, the energy is such a different thing because they're like, wow, we're really helping people get well, right? We're touching to that healer side of things. So that is really a clue as to where we need to be going. But when you look at the overall heavy administrative version, but yeah, so the individual provider, it's going to be very difficult to one, run a business, get paid sufficiently, because you have to have a team, right? In order to collect from insurance. And then if you decide to go all cash, well, that's going to limit your number of your patients, right? So you may be able to provide care to patients who can. So it's going to be middle class or upper middle class or higher. But now the people who really need our care, right? Those with limited incomes and rely on their insurance, even if they're making a living wage, they don't have access to doctors who maybe would be a better fit for them. So again, so we've just created this cyclone of disease and disease care. And it's hard to step out of because it takes a lot of,
Coronas.
It takes a lot.
I know. I mean, we see this hospitals and all of, you know, providers, insurances, they made their money on billing you when you're sick. That's why cancer, diabetes, and inflammatory diseases, Alzheimer's, name it, they make so much money for them. There, it is not an incentive on making money on, let's say, markers of improvement on the population or the patients. They don't. So what is really the incentive to see a patient getting better when on the contrary, they make their money by seeing the patient more times, having it admitted to the hospital, and you get into a hospital and you see how it is. The best tool that a nurse or a doctor has is that little barcode reader. They chin, 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 everything start billing. It is a business. So you're a business for them instead of an individual that needs care and get healing. Now, you touch on something that I don't want to let it go because I resonate so much with me what you just said. What if we have all of these physicians being force multipliers of wellness? Like we call it today's days, influencers on the wellness side. What if they have that freedom that they can be on that side of the wellness, really looking into the individuals to help them to get healing? That would be amazing. But what we see today, and Bruce can, you know, get us a little perspective on that, on the healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, actually being very unhealthy, many of them. So if those are your influencers and your healthcare providers, you're in front of someone that looks morbidly obese, that looks very unhealthy, is coughing in front of you, and you're receiving medical advice on how you can get better. But doctor,
sickness seems to be a better business if you just look at it from the business standpoint than wellness. Do you really want someone well, or do you want that patient coming back so you can order more tests? And, you know, if you're a hospital administrator, you want to fill the hospital up. You want capacity because, you know, they call it butts in the bed, but, you know, there's more charges that can be charged. There's room and board. There's so much that goes into it. More drugs can be sold. And again, not saying they're over prescribing this stuff, but to me, if we really want to impact the state of the health, we'll keep people out of the hospital. I take my car or my computer in for preventive maintenance. If it ends up in the garage because I didn't do something, I may have lost a transmission or some catastrophic thing with my machinery. If I'd have done preventive stuff, it wouldn't have ended up in that garage. And I sort of see that as the same comparison to what if we don't take care of ourselves, prevent maladies, then we can end up in the hospital. That's the garage. And that's going to cost you a lot of money.
Our Expressol Health and Wellness podcast is sponsored by Expressol Coffee. Expressol Coffee is our brand of coffee that we created with your health in mind. And as you know, you probably see this all over social media. We launched recently our Be The One Coffee, which is the coffee that is an initiative that we are doing with the American Legion to support Be The One program to help end veteran suicide. So every time you purchase Be The One coffee, you are part of the solution. You are helping to prevent veteran suicide. So just go www.expressolcoffee.com. You can use code LEGION for a 15% off of your order. And I want to thank you. Thank all of you who already purchased Be The One coffee, because you are helping veterans in need. You are being part of the solution. For all of you that still don't know how delicious, how amazing is our coffee, and you want to be part of the solution, go to www.expressolcoffee.com, enter code LEGION for 15% off your purchase, and remember, shipping is free on all orders over $50. Thank you for your support.
Well, no, I think basically at the base of this all is, like you said, it's we've turned this into a profit machine, and we have forgotten at the end of the road is a human being, right? And so for them, it's a disease, it's a number, but it's a human being, and we've really forgotten what that is. We're caring for human beings. And unfortunately, once a machine is built, and for your livelihood to keep your job, you're going to make sure your certain cash cows, your cardiology, interventional cardiologist, your whatever are going to be staying busy, right? And so you build up a referral machine from your primary care doctors, and that's all they are. Because typically primary care is a loss leader, right? Because we aren't going to be doing the interventions of the typical billing that will make you money. Now, there is some shifting, right, that comes from a capitated type system, and there's a few different ways to employ that. But at the end of the day, what's happening is that doctor now is becoming more responsible for the outcome of their patients. The unfortunate thing is they still have to see enough patients, and they are not trained in understanding how to engage patients for behavior change and understand what are the really movers of health. What are those levers that we can push and pull to help someone really be able to decrease medication, decrease their chronic disease burden, and improve their quality of life? What physicians are missing is that we've forgotten why we went into medical school to begin with, number one. And number two, you just get caught up in the system and they're sick too. So doctors are sick, like you said, Claudia, we are still human at the end of the day. And they're overeating, they might be smoking or drinking or whatever, and highly stressed. And unfortunately, many doctors are leaving early, right? They're changing careers. I don't know how many ads I see on Facebook, like, physicians, go into real estate. Physicians, do this. Physician, you know, so they're literally pulling out of the system because they're like, dude, why would I stay? I can go make money doing something else. I'm smart. I got through medical school. I certainly could do that. And so now it's what you're seeing, right? And so, yeah, it's
or
a very sick system.
Going into the functional medicine side too, which is like, I really want to help my patients and I can't do it under the system. So there's more and more, and I can see that it's a growing movement into more offerings into the concierge doctors, where you have, what you mentioned, more time to talk to your doctor. The doctor has more time to know about you. You know, it's not the 3 minutes, tell me quickly, here is your medication, next.
Right.
You really can see your patients with more care.
Right. Doctor, I hear a lot of times people say, we have the best healthcare system in the world. The numbers really don't bear that out if you're spending $5 trillion and you rank 69th. So what is your feeling? I mean, I think break fix, if you have a trauma, you have a broken leg, you end up in the ED, it's excellent.
Best.
I think if you have complicated surgeries and you're an air potentate and can afford the cost of, you know, the highest quality in the country, the U.S. is a place to go. But in terms of general health care, I mean, I've been to other countries like Southeast Asia, and my wife's country, her brother-in-law is a physician in Colombia, and I've seen systems that are very adequate at a fraction of the cost.
Yeah,
so,
no, absolutely.
I mean, do you believe broadly that we have the best system in the world?
I agree with you. You can absolutely do more with less. I've been to Ecuador. I was on a humanitarian trip, but I was in the Air Force. I've been to Uganda on medical missions, and I know what you can do with minimal, right? And so the thing is, we're dealing with such a sick population because our system of living is also creating illness. It's not just that the healthcare system fix us. Well, the freaking system needs to be fixed. The entire thing needs to be fixed.
So it needs to be turned upside down.
Exactly. Everything. Our food system. Why is it cheaper to buy junk food than it is to buy healthy food? Why is there, literally food deserts where people cannot have access within walking distance to healthy foods at an affordable price? And so, again, the entire system is broken. But would I say that we have I think we have amazing, amazing people that are smart and dedicated to their patients. Mm-hmm. And I think without constraints of see this many patients and prescribe these drugs and you're going to get sued or patients aren't happy. If you removed those constraints, you would see blossom an entirely different healthcare system. And now that would allow what these people understand, because one, their curiosity to come back. They're going to go spend time to educate patients on when you look at the guidelines, lifestyle is always up there, right? It's always mm-hmm. recommended. If we take time to educate these doctors without adding more stress, like, okay, there's one more thing you have to do. Understanding what lifestyle measures can really, change the bar. If we put in health coaches, if we allowed psychologists to be there to help deal with the mental health burden, literally build a team to support that doctor as a leader of that person's health, and then partner with the patient themselves, you would see an entire shift occur. But until we remove those constraints and start really understanding the system and that it really feeds itself of illness, I mean, we don't need terrorists. We're very good. We're destroying ourselves from within. And it literally starts with at the top and at the bottom. The patients are making different choices because they feel they can't make a different choice or they're addicted to something. And at the top, we're being pressured, to do things. We're lobbyists, and they don't appear, doesn't care about us. And the companies and everything that are feeding the system doesn't care either. They're looking at the dollars, like you said. And it's a broken system. But again, if you looked at a system that has little, allowed the doctor to do what the doctor wants to do and really care for the patient, you would see a different healthcare system altogether.
You have a wonderful specialty in lifestyle, because I totally believe in that. I'm 75. I'll be 76 in August.
And happy birthday.
Thank you. And I go out to the Legion Post and I see guys my age, Vietnam veterans, belly up to the bar, drinking beer, eating hamburgers. I go to the VA system. I see people that, with walkers who are probably my age or younger. They say if you're 70 years old and you fall down, most people can't get themselves up.
Right.
That's not me.
Right.
And that is lifestyle. I don't drink. Right. I exercise regularly. I watch my weight. These seem to be simple things that you can do. When somebody asks me who my healthcare provider is, I say me, because I take responsibility for that. So there seems to be some things that we can do, better than us in the lifestyle world. And obesity seems to be one of the big things that contribute to chronic disease like diabetes and things of that. Could you talk about that a little bit, about the problem that we have that seems to be epidemic in this country of obesity?
Yeah. So I think it's upwards of 80% of the American population is overweight or obese at this point. And unfortunately, with that comes a host of friends: diabetes, heart disease, which is the number one killer of men and women, is cardiovascular disease, hypertension, high cholesterol, cancer, you name it, we can keep going. So we understand with obesity comes illness. So what is at the root of the obesity epidemic? Again, it gets back to a system situation. We are also humans, and we have this brain that is made for a different time. It's not made for modern times. The brain's like, I don't know what to do here, but I'm just going to keep doing what I've always been doing. And if you call it the caveman brain, right? So let's say, for example, that you're a child and you go to a birthday party. You are fun. It is with your friends. You are so excited. You're just like, yeah, this is great. You are served ice cream. You are served cake.
Cake.
Woo! Sugar, sweet, delicious. Mmm, yum. happy brain is on dopamine high, like, sweet, I'm with my friends, I'm happy, I'm social, great. It remembers that. The brain's like, food, feel good, remember where that is. Because,
sugar.
Well, that's sugar's piece of it. As we, and salt and high fat foods, as we start moving around in life and we grow, maybe we become a teenager and we're hanging out with our friends and they're, you know, they're like, hey, you want to try smoking? Okay, now we try smoking and we have nicotine, right? Although smoking is kind of falling out of faith, thank goodness, in this country. Or they tried alcohol, right? So that made them feel less stressed and relaxed in that sense. So when you start thinking about all these different things as our brains are developing, maybe they try marijuana or they try some other drug. Now, as we move into adulthood or we eat food, right? So you look at the ultra-processed foods, sugar, salt, fat, oily foods, they also give you that dopamine hit. The brain's like, tastes good. And the food scientists literally create these foods to hit a bliss point, right? What's just enough of that, so I'll keep eating it. They work at making it where it melts in your mouth. You're like, well, I feel like I need another one and another one. So the brain is taking all this in. Exactly. The brain is taking, but the brain is like, I need to eat because tomorrow I may not eat, right? Because it's thinking there was times of feast and there was times of famine, but we never have a famine anymore. We're always in feast and we're not eating natural foods. So even if we lived in the environment that we do, if we took ultra processed foods out of the equation and we stopped subsidizing meat and dairy, I think you're going to see a very huge shift of what's available. You're going to see people eating primarily whole plant foods. They may still meet some animal products, but it would be less because it's less resource intensive to grow healthy plant foods. That's when you're going to start seeing a shift in people's health. And that's what I've seen for well over a decade to practicing this type of way of living in medicine with patients. But anyway, the obesity piece here is really a matter of understanding why we should make these choices to begin with, right? It's not necessarily the person's fault. Now, once they're aware of that, now we have to understand, we have to train them and educate them that you can be, like you said, you're the healthcare provider of your own health, right? So you are the provider of your health by making different daily decisions. But people feel, again, when they are stressed, the brain's like, remember that time you had that ice cream and cake? I think we're stressed, so we should go get some so I feel better. So then they go and equate food, right? So we lose track of what's intuitive hunger. We feed emotions. We don't understand how to break that cycle, but it really is a habit. And so once you understand what that is, and that a big part of my work with patients is the psychology of weight loss and understanding mindfulness. And, you know, if you look at studies, every hour, 60 minutes, 58 of those, we're either living in the future or we're ruminating about the past. We're never in the present moment. We're never looking at what can I do in this moment. They're always thinking about different things that have nothing to do with the current situation. And so they're trying to avoid something by daydreaming or moving forward in a fictitious future, or they're ruminating about a past. It's only energized when you give it attention. There's so much psychology to it, and the food system. And so the brain, like I said, the brain is only doing what the brain has evolved to do. And that's the root, the hard piece of it.
Let me ask you something real quick, just as a follow-up here.
Yeah.
Because yes, the brain does what it does and it gets familiar with certain things.
Uh-huh.
But when we are talking about it, an inflammatory disease as obesity, and we got the system supporting the people getting addicted to those foods, I think it's very important that we reinforce the idea that you're responsible for your own health. It's not, I'm waiting for someone else to fix it. I need to fix my system first so I don't have to go to that system.
Right.
And I know it's a lot of psychological components, but in a regular sense, and I know it's just a chain on reactions, what you eat, and then create your microbiome. Your microbiome is telling, you know, to the brain, is sending messages to your brain. People get depressed, get isolated. It's a lot of distractions. So when people are eating, most of the times they don't even think about what they're eating. They're watching TV, they're watching the phone. So it's glue, 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 contributing to the problem. What are simple steps that we can tell our audience it can be taken for anyone to start breaking the cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you said is really important and points to the problem is the mindless eating, right? Or the reactionary eating. And once you understand that there's a cycle, it's a habit, it's a habit loop. Just like when your bladder says you have to go to the bathroom, you go to the bathroom, right? Or when you drive, you don't even remember how you got somewhere because you don't like, oh, I turned on the turn. So this is basically the cycle that we're in. It's mindlessness. And so how do we bring on the thinking brain is really just that awareness that you start there, right? And so then when patients see, there's three things that will comprise a behavior, right? You have to have a prompt or a trigger. Then you have the ability to do it and then the motivation. I can say that motivation is a finicky friend. It'll show up. Sometimes it won't. Willpower is not going to be, there's even some thought suggestion that willpower doesn't truly exist. And if we do have it, it's a very limited supply because people might be highly motivated in the morning at the beginning of a year. And by the end of the day, they're like, I'm exhausted. I'm going through the drive-thru. But those three things have to be in place in order for you to see something happen. So what I tell patients is we want to build a mindful habit. So let's say I have a great story. I had an interview on my podcast of Dotsie Bosch. She is an Olympian. She was the oldest woman to win an Olympic medal in track cycling. And before she went to a whole food plant-based diet, I learned as I was researching and getting ready for the interview that she had a cocaine habit and an eating disorder. I was more interested in why she and how she overcame that because I was like, okay, that is very, very interesting. And what she told me when I asked her that question during that interview, she goes, well, I found a therapist that would let me do what I want to do. And I'm like, okay, this makes no sense. What do you mean by that? She goes, well, she just let me make the choice. And this is what she did. She goes, she gave me these little blue dots and she made me put them on anything that triggered or prompted me to do the behavior, right? Of whatever that was. Was it? Yeah, exactly. The bulimia or overeating or to do whatever how she did her cocaine. I don't know. But anyway, so she said, what was happening? She said, when I saw the blue dot, I was supposed to take 30 seconds or a minute or so and stop. So she's giving herself time and space, and you have to have space before you can interrupt a habit or a cycle, right? You have to give yourself time and space instead of just reacting out of complete subconscious, unconsciously. That blue dot was like, okay, I'm going to halt for 30 seconds. And then they started this. She goes, I gently probed without judgment, without shame. What was going on here? Why am I heading towards a cabinet to grab something to eat? Okay. Well, I was stressed. Am I really hungry? How's my body feel? Right. So she became from mindless to mindful. And that was the key. She goes, you know, so I did that. And then at the end of my 30 seconds of investigation, she goes, I was given the choice. I could pursue the behavior that I was going to do, or I could make a different choice. She goes, you know, the first few months I was like, screw this. I'm going to do what I want. And she would go ahead and engage in the behaviors. But over time, what happened was the reward of that habit loop. Because remember, a habit loop is a trigger. There's the behavior and there's that reward of that dopamine hit, that whatever it is. What was happening was the reward was dampening because as she was coming online and being mindful and being curious, which in and of itself will give you a dopamine hit, she was understanding that the reward was not all that great. And her brain was like, oh, so we don't want to do this. It's not as rewarding as we thought. Then we don't want to do it. And she goes, 3-4 months later, I had no desire. And now it's 20 years later and she was perfectly fine. So that is really the key here is if you have a habit of anything that you want to break, you have to remove the reward. And the way to do that is to remove the mindless component of it. One more quick story to share what that looks like. I had a patient, and this is before I even ventured into lifestyle medicine, but it totally played out the same way. I had a patient in rural Colorado. So I lived in a town called Rifle, Colorado. And this patient, he smoked, I don't know, 3 packs a day. It's insane to me how someone even has time to do that. But, you know, he had been smoking that way for 40 years. I did my duty as a doctor. I was like, you're going to get lung cancer. It costs a lot of money. And I tried to figure out everything I can to encourage him to or educate him to make better choices. And he's like, Dr. Morris, I just like doing it. And I was like, you know, I can't help everyone. Okay, do what you got to do. He came in to see me for a follow-up. And he's like, well, Dr. Marbus, I quit smoking. I was like, well, tell me what you did, because it was nothing that I ever did or said. And he said, well, basically, I was sitting in my chair smoking and my granddaughter came up to me and she was crying. And she's like, Pup, I don't understand. I just don't want you to die. And she's like, darling, you're in either Texas or Colorado when they say darling, but darling, I'm not going to die. And she goes, I learned in school that people who smoke die, and you smoke and that means you're going to die, and I don't want you to die. He said, I put out that cigarette and I've never had a desire to smoke another one. So here he has one of the most addictive habits you can have in smoking for decades, multiple times a year, reinforced the neural tract. And with one interaction, because he cared so much for his granddaughter, the thought of her suffering was way more of like something of a reward, right? Or exactly. He's like, I cannot do that. So the reward just went through the floor. And that is how that cycle broke. So that is a great example of how you go from being mindless to mindful. And it's an exercise. It's a muscle that you have to work. And you can do it in anything that you do, daily activities. It's a game changer for people.
I read that during the pandemic, during COVID, more people that were obese were impacted disproportionately at a higher percentage than people that were, you know, reasonably good shape. Did it really impact? Of course, it impacted the elderly, but also particular people that were overweight. If you were elderly and overweight, it was like a, you know, double whammy there. But
right.
That said, obesity obviously is a big problem. Now, Claudia and I just got back from Thailand and Vietnam, where the average per capita income is less than $7,000 a year. And we saw no one obese. We saw no homeless, not one person. We went to Saigon. We went to Chiang Mai, all over both of those countries, very poor countries. But they don't appear to be poor because they're healthy. There's actually a blue zone there where people live to be 100 or more. And same way in Colombia, where Claudia is from, a third world country, but her relatives, one of them's a doctor, when they come here, they're astounded by the amount of food that they see Americans eat.
Portions.
Not only the type of food, but the amount that they're just blown away.
Right.
So any comment on that? I mean,
yes. Oh my goodness. Again, so we aren't feeding our intuitive hunger, right? So I think people forget what hunger feels like, true hunger. Like I need to eat. And I think this is where you'll see some people do really well with what we call time-restricted feeding, or intermittent fasting is another popular term, where, you know, maybe the feeding window is 8 hours, right? And then they're fasting 16 hours because they consume those foods. Now, granted, these people are typically already on a healthier track, so they're going to be probably making healthier choices. But it does limit the portions and the amount of food that we're consuming. Not only is the portions larger, but the food content, if you look at the calorie density of these foods, of these processed foods, is extremely high. So I would, if you were to eat the equivalent of whole plant foods with their fiber and, you know, the, when they stretch the stomach and they send out the signals to the brain and they're literally calling the GLP-1s, right? So fiber does that. A certain amount of fiber and different carbohydrates and different things will send your own GLP-1s. Those are the shots that people are getting. They're so expensive now that, restrict appetite. They will occur naturally. You cannot eat the equivalent of broccoli or beans and rice to the equivalent of like a Big Mac and soda. I mean, you would be like, I can't eat another bite. So because they're feeling so full. That's the one thing that I have enjoyed with a whole food plant-based diet approach with patients is, number one, it's very anti-inflammatory. People feel very full very quickly. I have taken people who are type 2 diabetics for well over a decade and literally stopped 60 units of insulin in 72 hours. And I have one patient that's lost 350 pounds. I have other patients who have lost 200 pounds, many that have lost 100 pounds without surgery, without drugs. They just change what's on their plate and they make different choices. They feel better. The inflammation's gone. Autoimmune disease, headaches, skin disease, digestion. You name it. I've been on a plant-based diet myself for 12 years. I'm in my mid-50s. My oldest child is 30. My other two, and they're up in the older 20s. We're all doing great. My husband lost 70 pounds when he went on a plant-based diet 12 years ago. And I didn't ever have a weight issue. But I will tell you, as I'm entering into midlife, I'm like, well, if this is midlife, okay, let's keep going. And so, you know, this is how it is. But I also make active choices that I am not going to be consuming the foods. I'm not going to be sedentary. I walk on average 15 to 20,000 steps daily. I own my own business. I run, see patients. I've raised children. I get that people are busy and I've heard every conceivable decision. But again, at the end of the day, like you said, it's your decision. You decide if you want to continue suffering, we'll keep making the same choices. If you're done suffering, make a different choice. And you can start small. Small steps are the key. Yep.
Okay. Doug, I have a question about that, but before my question.
Yeah.
There is a lot of noise, I would say, in social media, national TV, regarding in a study that was published by the American Heart Association last week. And basically on this research, they presented doubts of the benefits of the intermittent fasting. Actually, yeah. They said if you are in intermittent fasting, you are putting yourself in 91% more risk to die out of cardiovascular disease.
So,
I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I did. And so I'm really good friends with Dr. Kim Williams, who was a past president of the American College of Cardiology. And I actually sent that to him. I was like, here's the AJ. It was set as a conference presentation. So the actual study has not been published yet, right? So there's going to be confounders. I would have to look at the study, right? So again, you can take any number crunching and you can make it against or for whatever your dogma is, right? But if we look at across, even just observational studies, for example, blue zones are a great example. Where in this world do people live to be over 100 and not just 100 in a nursing home dribbling? They're literally still working in the gardens. They're walking. They're living independently. They're living active lives. These people are eating a primarily whole food plant-based diet. They eat probably limited portions of food because they have to make it. They're living. They're outside gardening, doing all these amazing things. I am going to be hard pressed to think that if someone's only eating in an 8-hour window, that suddenly you're 91% higher risk. Until I can see the actual data, and this was actual observational data, right? This was not an interventional study from what I can gather when I read it. And so again, this is going to confuse the masses. It confuses doctors. Doctors are not trained to read scientific studies. You'd think they would be, but they're not. And the thing is that when you read maybe just an abstract or you hear some blogger talk about it or read an article across some news link, you just automatically trust like, oh my goodness, I can't do intermittent fasting anymore. I've lost weight and reversed my diabetes, but I don't want to die of a heart attack. I guess I'll go back to eating, you know, 12, 16 hours a day. And now we have someone overeating again. So again, I am hard pressed to believe that we need to take it for that one sentence. So like, what is the data? What is that? What are they actually doing? What are the confounders? What does this actually mean? Again, this is the dangers of social media and how people can take something and just blow it out of proportion. And then people don't trust like what I've been told by my doctor to try this intermittent fasting. I just want people to shift to start eating more fiber. We're in a fiber deficient world. I'm like, even if you took the time restricted feeding out of that, let's talk about just eating more fiber. Because at the end of the day, fiber is our friend and we need to eat more fiber. Mm-hmm. When people do that, guess what? It only comes from plants, and plants are the win in every situation.
Thank you very much for listening. And if you like the information that we shared with you today, please subscribe to the Express Soul Health and Wellness podcast and follow us in the social media outlets of your choice. Until next time, please remember, health is wealth for the body, mind, and soul.